This is what happens with promises. God gives a promise by His grace. Okay. And I'm not talking now about the... certainly the Bible promises fall under that category also. But that's not what I'm referring to right now. I'm referring to something specific that the Holy Spirit gives to an individual pertaining to their life. And He does that. So we get a promise from God, and this is a form of a rhema. So we are to live by every word, every rhema that proceeds out of the mouth of God. And that is something specific for my life, strictly for my life. My rhemas do not pertain to you. Okay, my rhemas do not pertain to you, they pertain to me. Now you guys are getting married, so if you have a rhema from God, a promise from God that you are to marry him, and he gets a promise from God that you are to, and not you putting it in his ear or he putting it in yours, but individually before God you get a rhema. This is what you live by. That doesn't pertain to me. It pertains to the two of you, but not to me. And God does that. This is how God deals with individuals. This is what it means to have a believer priesthood. As that God deals with me as an individual, and He speaks to me as an individual, He orders my steps as an individual. This is why He said to Peter, "What is that to you, what I do with John? I deal with John and I deal with you, and you don't worry about John." This is one of the reasons why also why when someone falls into some sort of sin that I can't do anything outside of the organization that God gives to dealing with sin. I go to the person alone. If I don't have the proof, I don't try to do anything more about it. Because God is very capable of dealing with them. Right? And so God will deal with them individually. Right? This is why Pastor Stevens, I was listening to a message from him recently, you don't deal with pastors the way that people like to deal with them. That's not to say a pastor can't be approached by somebody. That's not what I'm referring to. But generally speaking, you don't deal with pastors. Why? Because God deals with pastors. Does that mean that if a pastor falls into sin, somebody can't come up? No, that's not what I'm saying. But if a pastor seems to be going a little bit this way or a little bit that way, God can deal with the pastor. Now, how does a promise work? I'm going about my business and God speaks to me. Okay? It's pure grace. There's nothing that I do to deserve it. It's nothing that I can do to predict it. There's nothing that I do about it. God simply says this. And this is my message. This is what I'm telling you. And it can be about anything. This is what I'm telling you. Now, at that point, it is very easy for a believer to be afraid or to anticipate it to such a degree that believer tries to make it happen. Neither one of them is the right response. Mary had the right response. Right? You're single, you're 16, you've never been with a man, you're going to have a child. According to your word, be it unto me. Now, Mary didn't go about doing anything about it. I mean, there was nothing she could do about it. She just said, according to your word, be it unto me. And the rest was up to the Holy Spirit. Abraham had a promise from God and Sarah. And Abraham, though, and Sarah tried to do something about it. They wanted that promise. Abraham was very upset that he didn't have his own son. And so they wanted that promise very badly. And can you imagine the hope of that? Like, in those cultures, back in those days, to not have a son was really bad news. And he desperately wanted a son. And God says to Abraham, okay, you're going to have a son. You're 100 years old. Your wife is 90 years old. You're going to have a son. So for all this time, this couple is wanting and now has come to terms with the fact that they will never have a son. And God says, you're going to have one. But he didn't tell them the time. And because he didn't tell them the time, they got anxious and they tried to produce the son because they limited God's sovereignty and God's ability with their construed, humanly construed conceptualizations of time. Like, I mean, time was ticking at 100. So how's this going to happen? Okay, Sarah can't have children. She was barren to begin with, and now she's barren and old. Okay, Abraham's too old. He can't have any children. How is he going to have children at 100 years old? I mean, you know. But they figure out, well, apparently, you know, he could, because he went with Hagar and they had a son. But that was a terrible mistake. That was him trying to make something happen. Notice God didn't prevent him in his own free volition from having a son that wasn't of God. Because they wouldn't wait for the promise. Now, when I get a promise, I have to realize something in Habakkuk 2:3. The vision is yet for an appointed time. And though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come and it will not tarry. In other words, though you'll have to wait for this promise, though there's a certain amount of time that you have to wait to receive this, wait for it. Because when the time is right, it will come quickly. So when I receive a promise from God, I have to look at it from a finished work perspective. I have to realize that when God gives a promise, the work has already been completed. Right? The work's been finished from the foundation of the world. Isn't that what the apostle said? The work was finished from the foundation of the world. So it's already a done deal. Right? So I can get anxious if I want, or I can be fearful if I want, like the Israelites were fearful of the promise. But it was already a done deal. The question was the time. Now what Israel showed us is that I can actually postpone the promises of God. But nowhere in the Bible does it show me a place where I can bring them forward. So what do I do if I receive the promise? I wait. I wait on God. I store it in my heart and say to God, God, according to your word, be it unto me. And I wait. And in the waiting, I draw near to Him. Now what can happen to a believer, like is what happened to Abraham, where the promise becomes an idol. What's an idol? That which can cause me to act apart from the will of God. There's an idol. So Abraham had an idol and Sarah had an idol. And part of their idol was their own mentality, their own ability to figure it out was their idol. And their anticipation, eagerness, impatience with God. And they wanted a son so bad, and they didn't trust God to such a significant point where they would say, okay, we'll have to do it ourselves. Doesn't work that way. Yes, they produced the son, but it was the wrong son. It was not the promised son, and eventually it wasn't even Abraham's son. He couldn't keep him. You see, there is the danger of me trying to bring about a promise, is I can't keep what I produce. I can only keep what God produces. Now, even in the natural realm, married couples in the world, they can't keep each other. Right? Even if they don't ever divorce, even if they stay married till they're both 120, they can't keep each other. But a promise from God, I can't lose. Now, if I do something to try to make it happen, I can't keep what I tried. The only time I will receive the promise is when God gives the promise. When God causes it to come to pass, just like with Isaac. So, my unbelief will not diminish God's promise. It may delay it until the capacity is built in me to receive it. But it won't diminish it. I mean, Abraham still received Isaac. Israel still entered into the promised land. Right? Mary, she didn't respond in unbelief. But who did respond in unbelief? Elizabeth's husband. Right? But Elizabeth did not respond in unbelief. So Elizabeth's husband was made mute because he didn't believe. I think it's interesting that he was a priest who was made mute from unbelief. There's a message, isn't it? So what do I do? I say, what the priest should have done is what the 16-year-old girl did. Instead of challenging God with, of course, he's got all this wisdom and experience now. Right? Instead of challenging God, God, I know how this works, and you know, it's just a little old there, man. It's not going to happen like this. No, he didn't know beans. The 16-year-old girl knew more. Lord, according to your word, be it unto me. That's the only thing I can do. Now, God gives me a promise. Lord, according to your word, be it unto me. You know what? Because a promise is a kind of a funny thing. A promise is not... You know what a promise is not? A promise is not God's request that I agree. Now, it's not God asking me my opinion. What do you think if we did this? How are you with that? What do you think if we did this? Like when I got called to be a pastor, God didn't ask me what I thought about it. He just said, this is what's going to happen. So it's not, you know, it's not God looking for my opinion of his will. When did that happen? People asking God, you know, taking their opinion toward God's will. That happened with Job, didn't it? Yeah, that happened with Job. Job was being tried in the will of God. And his friends were giving their opinion of God's will. Now what did God say? Job, pray for these guys. He didn't talk to them. He talked to Job. Well, he didn't even talk to them. But he did talk to Job. God's not interested in my opinion of his will. My opinion of God's will has absolutely not one ounce of weight with God. And if I try to give my opinion of God's will, it doesn't really go well for me. It's just not a good thing to do. Who in the Bible tried to give their opinion of God's will?
Jonah.
I'm sorry?
Jonah.
Jonah, in some respects, yeah, when you're... Oh, he did, the gourd, right? The gourd, yes.
Michael, the wife of David.
Yeah.
Very good.
Ananias and Sapphira, I don't really know.
Okay, Ananias and Sapphira were just a little bit different. They weren't giving an opinion, they were lying to the Holy Spirit.
Miriam
and Moses, right? The leprosy.
Jezebel.
What's that?
No.
Jezebel, well, that was an interesting one. Yeah, she was... but God doesn't ask me my opinion. God tells me His. And He says, you know what? If you have any brains at all, you will make this your opinion also. God doesn't ask my opinions. God doesn't ask me for when I think things should happen. Like, can you imagine this? Abraham, I'm going to blow up Sodom. When do you think we should do it? Like, what do you think would be good timing? Autumn? Should we do it in the fall? Summer? Like, what would be the best time of year? Like, how much time do you think we should give him, Abraham? No, God told Abraham the day before it happened. I said, Abraham, Sodom is going to be history. God, there's five. I said, yeah, okay, fine. If you want to pray for them, I'll do it. You know why that worked? Because God would have done it anyway. That thing, there would have been one, even if Abraham didn't ask for one. If he had representative status. He wasn't a remnant believer. He was a believer, but he held no power with God because of sin in his life. So God doesn't ask my opinion. God just shares with me what He's going to do. Then that's what a promise is. In a manner of speaking, God promised Abraham that He would destroy Sodom. We don't think of that as a promise. But any time that God tells me what's going to happen, it's a promise. Why? Because God doesn't operate in any other way. Like, God can't say this is going to happen and then not do it. Right. Now, in the Bible, you have instances like Moses, you know, God, if you know, take me with him, okay, it repented, and okay, I won't destroy him for your sake. But you know what? God was simply reeling Moses in. That's all he was doing there. God knew very well whether he would destroy or not destroy. How do I know that? Because he said it after the flood. Right. And he already gave promises concerning Israel. So God knew very well he wasn't going to destroy Israel. He gave that promise to Abraham. No. When God gives a promise, He's simply telling me what He's going to do. But what is a promise when He tells me what He's going to do with my life? So how do you handle a promise? You wait on God. You don't get anxious. You don't get afraid. You don't run to it. You don't run away from it. You certainly don't make it your idol. You simply say in your heart, according to your will, be it unto me, and know that God is more than able to do what He said He would do. Faithful is He that called you who will also do it. The thing that believers have is they want to put a limit on God with time. Because we're very temporarily oriented. And so if things don't happen on our time frame, God says, I'm not that interested in your time frame. God lives in eternity. He says, I know the beginning from the end. Or I know the end from the beginning. I know exactly when it's going to come to pass. And if that doesn't seem to suit your preferences today, that's okay. It's going to happen when I said. The funny thing with this is whenever that happens, and like we get a promise from God and we say, okay, yesterday, Then when we finally get to that place, we realize, wow, glad it wasn't yesterday. See, we don't know our own changes of mind. But God doesn't change His mind. Right? That's the part of the thing about not knowing anything. I know nothing. Only thing I know is what God tells me. And so, I don't know when I'm going to change my mind. Today, I can't imagine changing my mind. But tomorrow, I can. I can change my mind. And sometimes right and sometimes wrong. Tomorrow, I can. Like, God doesn't know. I don't know what God knows. And all I can do is wait on God. And if God said it, He'll do it. And I don't have to strive in it. It's very simple. Some people have this, okay, God told you you would do it, go and do it. Well, yes, Sarah and Abraham did try that. But faithful is He who called you, who will also do it. It's not for me to do it, it's for Him to do it. He gave the call, He'll do the doing. What do I become willing toward Him to respond in a volitional choice positively toward His will as He reveals it to me. And He may not reveal it to me in the way that I think He should. Like when I came here, God didn't say go to Westminster. When I came here, God says nothing to my understanding at all. There's a need, and I prayed, and I say, God, you're going to have to open a door, because when the door opens, I'm going to go through it. I say, you're going to have to open the door, because there's a real need. And it was a real need. It was a legitimate need. And all I'm thinking, okay, you're getting a provision for the need. What I'm not realizing is that God is bringing the call. So it was the steps of the righteous being ordered by the Lord. I didn't strive to become a pastor. It just kind of happened because the steps of the righteous got ordered by the Lord. And there it comes. And when I receive a promise, it could very well be that God's going to say, okay, now, or that He's not going to say a word and simply order steps. And when that happens, you know, that's just as much God as, you know, when He talked to Noah. So, promises are something that I cling to for hope, for comfort, for encouragement, for definition, but I can't make them happen. They're simply God saying, this is what I am going to do. Now, I can believe it or I cannot believe it. But Sarah didn't believe it and it happened anyway. That's the thing. Jonah didn't believe it, didn't want to believe it, and it happened anyway. It doesn't matter whether I want or not want. It's a question of what God wants. And if God wants it, so let's do it. And at that point, if I'm in negative towards the promise, okay, maybe it's something that I don't like in my natural, you know, reasoning, then I simply stay out of the way, knowing that He will make me willing. Right? He gives me the desires of my heart. He puts the desires into my heart. But it's going to come one way or the other. And He'll put the desire in my heart when the time is right. Right? You guys are a perfect example of that. He put the desire in your heart You weren't willing at first, by a long shot. But he had to. He changed your heart. And so, do I make things? No. Do I don't make things happen? I don't strive. Do I try to run away? No, I don't run away. I wait on God, and faithfully is He who's called you who also does it. It's important that a believer learn how to deal correctly with God's promises. Because if they can't, listen to this, if they cannot deal correctly with God's promises, then they cannot deal with their call, they cannot deal with sovereignty, they cannot deal with His will or His plan. And as a believer, everything is sovereign. Because I'm a believer priest. If there was one thing that was not sovereign, then I would not be a believer priest. Everything is sovereign. How is my life the same as anybody else's life? As a pastor, how am I a pastor the same as anybody else is a pastor? Or as any sort of a believer, how am I the same as anybody else? How is my call the same as anybody else's call? It's not. So long as I occupy my own little piece of eternity, everything is sovereign. Nothing is cookie cut. There's a specific role for every individual. That means everything is sovereign. And some things are just more obviously so than others. Like it's not necessarily obviously sovereign, perhaps that somebody is a pastor or goes missionary or goes soul winning here or there, but it is sovereign. It's just not as obvious as maybe Isaiah walking around naked. But it's nonetheless. So how do I deal with the promises? I wait upon the Lord. You see, this is the thing. What if the promise takes a response from me? Like Jonah, go to Nineveh. No. God gets me there anyway. God gets me there anyway. So what if I didn't have the wherewithal to respond to God at the right time? Does that stop God? No. It just means I might be introduced to a fish. But it doesn't stop God. So I don't have to be worried about how God's promises are going to come to pass. That's God's response. That's His job. Like even for Jonah, that was God's job. And when Jonah wasn't willing, God gave him 3 days to think about it.
Time out.
What's that?
Time out.
God gave him a time out. It's like Ken Ham asked, right? If it's not a day, the 6 days, if it's not a day, how long was Noah, Jonah in the fish? Was he there 3 million years? Yeah. The pearl of great price, right?
That was an interesting thought.
But how do I deal with God's promises? I don't. I respond when He says, okay, now this. But I don't. I don't deal with His promises. He deals with His promises. I deal with Him. Or actually, probably more accurately said, it'd be He deals with me. I deal with Him. Both. Because, I mean, it's a two-way street with God. There's an exchange, there's a reciprocity. You know, there's an exchange, there's a communion. So God says, okay, this, and I say, God, according to your word, be it unto me. Okay, Abraham, I'm not going to tell you when, but this is what's going to happen. Why does God do it that way? So that I'll trust Him. Right? In the end, I learn to trust Him when He does it that way. I mean, if God told Abraham, okay, in 13 years you're going to have a son, where's the trust element? Where's the renew your strength element? Right? Where's the thing that builds the believer? Yeah. And Jonah had this weird concept of nationalistic pride. I'm a Jew. I don't go to Nineveh, to the Ninevites. I'm a Jew. And these guys are pagan or heathen. These guys are heathen and they're vile, and I don't go among people like that. I don't do that. And God says, Jonah, you're going. Jonah says, I don't do that, God. Jonah was more righteous than God. Doesn't that happen with believers, though? They get this religious concept and they become more righteous than God. Can you imagine what the average believer would say about Isaiah? Okay, Isaiah, what is it, 3 years or something? Okay, Isaiah, 3 years, no clothes.
Right. Yeah, this is really. Why are you asking me to do these weird things? Am I on camera?
But can you imagine that? The average believer, Noah, take your clothes off, you're going to be walking around naked for 3 years. Excuse me, Jonah. Not Jonah, Isaiah.
Fred.
Prophet Fred. Isaiah, take your clothes off. You're walking around 3 years naked. Man, that guy's really cracked. He's really nuts. He's really cracked. What a weirdo. What a freak. What a freak. I wonder how much of that happened, right? I wonder how much. What a freak walking around naked. Who does he think he is? Like, who wants to see that? Go figure. Don't try to figure God out. You can't. It's one thing I've learned. I've had God say a number of things to me. You never figure Him out. I mean, who would have thunk I'd be here? No, really not. My parents live out here, and I used to visit them, and I think I could never be out here. I'd be so asleep spiritually. This place is dead as a doornail. It's palpable. You can feel, like, you can cut the atmosphere here. How spiritually asleep this place is. Like, it'll knock you out. But I would have never thought it. Go figure. Only thing that was in my heart is pray for somebody. I should pray that somebody sends somebody to Westminster. We need somebody out in Westminster. I remember thinking that we should get somebody out in Westminster. God, send somebody to Westminster. Good idea. Is it God's from West Virginia? Why do you believe God's from West Virginia?
Good idea.
Oh, must be getting tired.
Well,
but that's the thing. How do you deal with God's promises? You wait upon the Lord. And you see, according to your God's will, according to your will, be it unto me. Right. If a believer doesn't receive a rhema, does he know how to hear? You know? Really, if a believer doesn't know how to receive a rhema, how to hear? Does he know how to read? How to hear? If he doesn't receive a rhema, Jesus said, "My sheep will hear my voice." I'm not saying they're not saved, but I'm saying, do they know how to hear? Are they available to hear? So a lot of believers are not available to hear what they don't want to hear. Why? Preconceptualizations. Religious notions, thoughts that the world brings. And they don't want to hear. God, you can tell me anything except this and this and this. So what do you think God's going to tell you? This, this, and this. Because He's going to smash your little boxes. Right, God smashes boxes. He does. Because the problem with the box is I think I'm putting God in it, but I'm actually the one who's in it. If I have a religious box, or if I have this conceptualized box, I'm trapped in it. That's the thing. That's the area where I don't know Him. And so He smashes my box, so that I can know Him. Like, I'm sure Jonah was thinking, like, God's going to give him a call, and he's got a sense, and God's giving him a call, and he's saying, God, anywhere but Nineveh. And God says, Jonah, go to Nineveh. Your conceptualization from your religious upbringing and your nationalistic pride is getting in your way of knowing Me. Go to Nineveh. I mean, really, what do you believe? Like, how much do we bring into our Christianity that's not of Christ? Right? What do you believe? Sometimes it's like the dark side of morality. Sometimes it's a concept like what can or cannot be. Right? But what do you believe? Like that lady I worked with years ago, you can go to Russia. I'm not going to Russia. I mean, God's calling my husband to be a missionary. I am not going. He can go. I'm not going. What did she believe? She had this religious box of being a good doobie Christian, you know, a good Sunday morning Christian. But if God went outside her box, that was the end of it. You know, that was her comfort zone. God's always going to shake your comfort zone. God is not into your comfort zone. He will not let you keep your comfort zone. Why? Because you'll be on your knees. And passivity, dullness comes into the soul. Leanness comes into the soul when I'm there. God will not allow the believer to keep his comfort zone. If I have a comfort zone as a believer, God will smash through my comfort zone like one of them wrecking balls. That's what He'll do to my comfort zone. Why? Because I don't believe in my comfort zone. I'm comfortable there because I think that there requires no faith. Get this down. Don't ever become comfortable in a place that you think, that you only think, though, requires no faith. It's a deception. Only be comfortable in that which completely requires you to rely only on God. Because then you have something solid. But we think we have something solid when we don't have to rely only on God, when we don't have to rely only on faith, and we think we have some kind of a natural conceptualization or natural ability, natural provision. We don't have jack. Not that, we don't have beans. We don't have nothing. It's like that guy I ran into a few years ago, soul winning. $10 million in the morning. How easy is it to have $10 million as a comfort zone? He had 10 cents that same evening, and that was it. So much for his comfort zone, boy. Your comfort zone is your deception. That's all it is. Your comfort zone is your deception. The only comfort I have is from the Comforter. And when I rely only on the Comforter, then I have a comfort. But a comfort zone is nothing but deception. Yes.
Kind of like draw up a question in my mind. Like, I'm sure it doesn't, but maybe like clarification. Does that mean that our entire life as believers, like the purpose of our life is to be uncomfortable and tossed about with tempest and miserable people?
It's the opposite.
Our comfort zone is miserable?
No. If we are in a comfort zone, we will be miserable. Because the comfort zone is very natural. But the only place to become comfortable is in pure faith. And that's what God's trying to get me into. When I have a pure reliance on God, I'm not afraid of anything. That's a very comfortable place to be. But not in the natural sense. So my comfort zone is, in fact, my deception. Because I think that there is a place I can be comfortable apart from God. But if I'm completely relying on Christ, then nothing makes me uncomfortable. If I'm really trusting Him, then where is the place to lose my comfort? So no, it's actually the opposite. The purpose in life is to have contentment in whatsoever state I'm in. Because I'm spirit-filled, trusting God. Because I know Him.
Could we then not move to a position where you told us before to be in faith rest, and God will move us from a position of faith to faith.
Absolutely.
And therein lies our rest and our comfort.
Yeah. That's good. That's a good statement. My comfort zone is my comfort zone is my deception. Faith rest is my comfort.
One other question. I guess it's probably the same question, but so whatever box you have, like God will break, smash that box. I think it's, sometimes we get boxes like, oh, I really hope this devastating thing doesn't happen.
That's fear.
You know, is this person going to die or am I going to die? You know, is God going to just like take that person from me because I'm afraid of them?
No. God is not the author of fear, but of sound mind. Or confusion. Fear is a type of confusion. Right, here's a type of confusion whereby you're confused about your relationship to God. But when I know that He loves me, I'm not afraid anymore. So the question isn't a question of will God take them away from me if I'm afraid He'll take them. The question is, do you know the love of God? Right. So if I know the love of God, the question doesn't even enter into my mind because I'm not afraid. Now what if God does take that person away from me? It happens. Will He abandon me then? And if He does take them away from me, and presumably they're a believer, then how long has He taken me away from? How long has He separated us? How long will that last? Could last 60 years. Yeah, it could. Compared to eternity, though, 60 years will pass quickly. We just think in such linear temporal terms. But I mean, it happens to people all the time. They lose a child, a spouse, a good friend, a parent. You know, and they grieve the separation, and that's normal. But one of the things we forget is it's a separation. It's not a removal. In other words, the person moved out of town and they're moved to the place I'm going to also. They just moved first. What's that? Of course. Right. But there's your separation. And if the person isn't saved, why do I have that relationship with them? Oh, perhaps with a family member. That's possible. But then maybe God will save them. Like, when is the deadline for salvation? Right. Flatline. Flatline is the deadline. Right. But until that point, I have no way to say that somebody's going to not be saved. Especially since God often saves within families. There's your biggest point of salvation, is within families. So who knows? And how do I know that person really isn't? Well, maybe I know that they say, hey, I don't believe in God, I never have, never will. Well, yeah, then that's a pretty good indicator. But then again, if they haven't said that, maybe, you know, I can't help but wonder sometimes, you get these people who used to go to Sunday school, Sunday school teacher wins them to Christ, perhaps they're 8 years old, they leave Sunday school, leave church, go college, business world, live their life, die. Where do they go when they die? Well, at 8 years old, they got saved, backslid the rest of their life, but at 8 years old, they got saved. That's not uncommon. That's not uncommon. Like, do we believe that once you're saved, you're saved? Of course we do. The name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Never does it say anything about God erasing anything. Then you were never there.
Right. It says it will be taken out of the book of life, but not the Lamb's book of life. So different books. Right?
Different books. Yeah, book.
Thank you.
Anyway.